We haven't experienced many periods of American history quite like the post-9/11 years. People who hadn't thought that much about domestic security were suddenly painfully aware of what could happen. People whose business was public safety suddenly had a new set of concerns on their hands.
Almost immediately after 9/11, counterterrorism became the top priority of the Department of Justice.
We're about to get into how the day changed the institutions charged with keeping us safe and the implications those changes have had on a new era of domestic threats today. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. University of Michigan professor Barb McQuaid has had a long career in the law. She served for 7 years as the U.S. attorney for Eastern Michigan. But back in the fall of 2001, she was out on maternity leave from her job as a mid-career federal lawyer at the Department of Justice.
Prosecuting cases like bank robberies and counterfeiting violations and child exploitation cases, things like that, a real mixed bag.
When she returned to work after 9/11, her job had changed dramatically.
And one of the things that helped to facilitate that transformation was the passage of the USA Patriot Act. You may recall in October of 2001, very quickly. And many of the authorities there were things that the Department of Justice had been agitating for a long time that they just couldn't get the attention of Congress on. You know, like the ability to use wiretap technology on cell phones and the ability to obtain email messages, those kinds of things. The law had not kept up with the digital age. But of course, there were some other things that have since been scaled back or struck down as either bad ideas or bad policy or unconstitutional. But the mission of the department did change very much. Now, it wasn't that we stopped doing those other things. We had this counterterrorism mission added to our plate, but no doubt some of the resources that were previously working on other kinds of crimes were now focused on counterterrorism.
What was it like to go through that kind of a change? I mean, were investigative techniques going through a metamorphosis, or was it just a question of, as you say, adapting some tools to a use that everyone agreed was needed?
Much of it was an adaptation, but we did have to learn how to use new tools. So, for example, with the USA Patriot Act, we got some new authorities. One of the big changes was there had previously been what was referred to as the wall between criminal investigators at the FBI and counterintelligence investigators. And it was created for a good purpose. It came in response to abuses by the FBI in the 60s and 70s when they were, under the guise of national security, wiretapping people perceived to be political enemies or just politically dangerous, you know, like Vietnam War protesters and Black Panthers and groups like that. One of the things the Patriot Act did was to take down that wall and say, those were the best of intentions, but you've had disastrous results. And in fact, it was the wall that prevented the FBI in Minnesota from sharing with others that Zacharias Moussaoui had been taking flight lessons, but wasn't interested in taking off and landing, only doing the in-between flying parts. And so because of that wall, it had prevented the ability for the right hand to know what the left hand was doing. So part of the work was learning how to use these new authorities and what the limitations on them were. But another part of it was a lot of training for prosecutors. And we were trained by people who had done organized crime prosecutions in the past. So we adopted many of the strategies that were used in organized crime. Some of them are, you may have information that no one will testify to that this person's a killer, but they've also violated income tax laws. Okay, we'll charge them with income tax laws. Or, in the case of counterterrorism, it may be that the person has, on the intelligence side, has been trained as a fighter for a foreign terrorist organization, and they're in this country on visa fraud or immigration fraud or have engaged in some kind of financial fraud. And so that would be the charge. That was a technique that was adopted from organized crime. And the other technique adopted from organized crime and other kinds of predecessor crimes was the sting operation, using undercovers, using informants for people who had demonstrated an intent to commit a crime to try to stop them before they could go through with it.
So the way this would play out was, and people may have read or heard about some of these cases, federal law enforcement would try to identify people who might hold by U.S. standards, you know, extreme views of Islam or of just of the U.S. and its power within the world, within chat rooms and other online forums that were dedicated to radical Islamist ideals. And then agents and informants, if they thought it appropriate, would interact with these people online, get to know them, reach out to them under false pretenses of being sympathetic. And then sometimes, if deemed important, they would meet with them in person in the interests of getting to people before they got fully radicalized. Can you sort of lay out what role that played in the bigger strategy and just how, you know, if it was critical to the work that was being done at the time?
Yes. So in the same way that those kinds of techniques were used for internet child predators, for example, they were used for people who might be engaged in terrorism. And I should point out that before the FBI can engage with them, they have to have what is known as predication. And that is not just an extremist view of Islam, but an expression of a desire to commit a crime. So people can have whatever views they want of Islam. They can even have whatever views they want of a terrorist organization. They can, you know, say, you know, praise to ISIS or whatever it is. But it is the I am interested in killing people. I am interested in blowing up a school. We had a case in Detroit where someone expressed a desire to shoot up a church in Detroit. And then as he talked further, it became clear it was a specific church, a very large church in the city of Detroit. And so the idea there is to engage with them. And also a lawyer will be involved with the investigation and advising the agent or the undercover or the informant about what the rules of engagement can be. For example, we would always work very hard to steer clear of an entrapment defense, not only because it's wrong to entrap someone, but if you entrap someone, you will fail in your case and you will fail to convict someone you believe is a dangerous person and they will be back out on the street to harm others. So instead, the ideas, you know, needed to come from the person. And so it was really just talking to them, saying, tell me more and things like that. And then perhaps when the person said, you know, I want to shoot up a church or I want to blow up a building or whatever it was, at some point, people meet up with them and say, well, I could probably find a guy who can help. What do you need? And, you know, again, the words need to come from that person. And they'll say things like, I need a bomb. I need a timing device. I need this. Like, all right, well, maybe I can find a guy who can do that. What do you need? And so they say, let's meet on X date and, you know, we'll give you the stuff. But the other crucial thing about entrapment is the agents are always instructed to give the person kind of a last opportunity to get out. Are you sure you want to do this? Do you understand what this means? Do you realize that a lot of innocent people are going to die, including children? And those are all important steps to rebut an allegation of entrapment at trial. So the goal in FBI parlance is to stop a perpetrator left of boom. Boom being the moment on a timeline when an attack occurs or violence occurs. So left of boom is the goal whenever you're dealing with any sort of a violent activity that you want to stop before it happens.
Do you think that this strategy was successful, that there is such a thing as a latent threat that can be met by drawing it out before it becomes an issue?
I don't know, because you'll never know what you stopped by preventing it. I mean, there were certainly some plots underway to attack America that were disrupted. There was one involving bridges and tunnels in New York, the Abdulmutallab underwear bomber who tried to blow up a plane over Detroit. There was the shoe bomber and others. You know, they got disrupted because of intelligence collection, intelligence sharing, and the ability to strike hard against people in this country with ties to terrorist organizations. And so by disrupting that, I hope it was successful. I think in many ways it was successful. I think that there certainly, though, were examples of overreach. You know, there was a program that the New York Police Department was engaged in where they were just surveilling Muslims, which is, you know, not only unconstitutional, a violation of equal protection to go after one group and different from another, it's also a very inefficient method of law enforcement. You know, working with real information about conduct is what matters most. in cases not about, you know, profiling based on race or ethnicity or religion. And so I think there were some examples of overreach like that. We had a case in Detroit where there was some overreach where four men were charged with conspiracy to engage in a terrorist plot. They had videos of Disney World and other kinds of things. But that case unraveled because the prosecutor in that case not only failed to comply with his ethical requirements, he was ultimately charged with a crime. He was acquitted at trial. But, you know, certainly I think it would be fair to say engaged in some overreach. But I think that in those days after 9/11, there was a desire to use every possible legal tool to identify terrorists. You know, I think at that time, too, there was a real fear that there were more sleeper cells like the ones who did the 9/11 hijacking attack.
Got to take a quick break. When we return, how the past 20 years of investigative and legal practice have informed the government's approach to a rise in right-wing extremist violence here in the U.S. Be right back.
Support for the Stateside Podcast comes from the University of Michigan's Go Blue Guarantee, committed to keeping a U of M undergraduate education within reach of all Michigan residents, regardless of socioeconomic status. Programs are available for all three campuses. More at goblueguarantee.umich.edu.
Support for Michigan Public's Stateside Podcast comes from Lake Trust Credit Union, working to empower financial well-being for Michigan consumers, businesses, and communities. Committed to financial solutions and advice to support people and families. More information at laketrust.org.
In recent years, the most pressing domestic threats have shifted. The FBI and the Department of Justice are spending a lot more of their attention lately on white supremacist and anti-government groups. Are there ways in which you think the changes that took place after 9/11 and the experiences that the FBI and federal attorneys have, ways that that's informed the way that domestic threats are investigated now?
So I think so. I haven't been at the Justice Department now for about 4 years, but just watching what they're doing and say the investigation involving the alleged kidnapping plot against Governor Whitmer, it does seem like those same techniques are being used. Even when I was there, we had a case against a militia group in 2010 where we used those same techniques using an undercover FBI agent to infiltrate the group. You know, it is probably the best way to be able to listen to what they're saying is to have either people or listening devices in when groups are meeting to find out what they're up to. But, you know, again, all of these things come with safeguards. They come with protections of judicial oversight. To get a wiretap, you have to have probable cause that you're going to find evidence of a crime. It's not a perfect fit because the laws do not map perfectly onto each other. When there's an international actor, we have a lot of additional tools that are not available for domestic cases. And that's because of the extreme care that we have to protect people's First Amendment rights to free speech and free assembly. When people are gathering in our militia groups and are shooting guns, you know, all of those things are protected by the First Amendment. If you have a foreign actor, you have the ability to use FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, as long as you have probable cause that the person is acting as an agent of a foreign government or a foreign terrorist organization. So if a person has expressed any allegiance to ISIS or Al-Qaeda or something like that, you can use this FISA wiretap on them. You don't have that tool at all for domestic actors. It cannot be used if a person doesn't have any sort of tie to a foreign government or a foreign terrorist organization. Similarly, in the foreign terrorist realm, there is a crime of terrorism transcending national boundaries. And so if you have somebody acting here, but they're doing so on behalf of ISIS or Al-Qaeda, that transcends national boundaries, and you can very broadly look into things like even, like, say they're planning a mass shooting, they're going to shoot up a church. You could look at that and investigate that. For domestic terrorism, there is not a counterpart to that statute. There are many others, and most of the time you can find something. If people are planning to use a bomb, for example, that works. If you're planning a kidnapping, that works. So you have a few tools, fewer in the domestic arena, But I still think many of those same techniques are used, which is, you know, assessing threats in chat rooms, if you find predication, opening an investigation, and then engaging with people who have demonstrated an intent to commit acts of violence.
On September 10th, 2001, I venture to say you already had a pretty realistic view of things that can happen in the world. But were there ways in which September 11th changed your ideas about safety and security in this country?
Certainly. I had thought of terrorism as kind of a distant problem that occurred in other places. You know, there had been the USS Cole bombing, which was an Al-Qaeda attack on a U.S. ship, but it had happened overseas. You heard about this happening in London and England, but it was mostly a distant threat. I guess we'd had Oklahoma City, which probably should have been eye-opening, but that also seemed like, you know, kind of a one-off extremist. But I think 9/11 really hit a lot of us at home. You know, because I was home on maternity leave, I watched a lot of the coverage, probably too much, probably more than is healthy. But, you know, the stories of just good people going about their day, losing their lives, was so gut-wrenching. And, you know, it wasn't just there. It was also the plane at the Pentagon and the plane that went down in Shanksville. And of course, it was two planes at the World Trade Center. It made us very nervous, not only about aviation security, but you may also recall that right after that came that anthrax scare, where people were getting mailed anthrax and, you know, the mails were getting shut down, and you kind of felt like the whole world was falling apart. And so I felt like, personally, I wanted to do something about it. I wanted to help. And so, you know, having an opportunity at the U.S. Attorney's Office to join a counterterrorism unit was meaningful to me. And I always saw my job as working very hard to not only protect the public, but to do so in a way that ensured that we were complying with constitutional rights. And I'm very proud of the work that we did then. And I think it's always a delicate balance because, you know, I teach a course in national security and civil liberties. If you wanted to have a nation that was 100% safe, you could probably do that by having an authoritarian state where no one can ever, you know, go outside or engage in transactions or other things. But I don't think anybody wants that. We want a country where we're free because that's what makes America what it is. You know, we have freedom to go about our business, to do what we want, to express ourselves, to express ideas. Or you could also have a society at the way opposite end where everybody gets to do whatever they want all the time and there are no laws and we just go about our business and we're totally free. And I don't think anybody would want that either. I think that would lead to anarchy. And so the proper place is to look for that balance. Where do we fall in the middle? And so there are certain things that are absolutes in this country. Constitutional rights. You can't violate someone's rights against unreasonable searches and seizures. You can't violate someone's due process rights. You can't violate someone's equal protection rights. But within that, I think law enforcement had a duty to use all the tools that it had to do what it could, and to this day what it can, to disrupt these threats, whether it's coming from Al-Qaeda or it's coming from a militia group in rural Michigan that wants to kidnap the governor. I think law enforcement has a duty to do what it can within those parameters to protect the public.
We wanted to let you know that we spent some time on our broadcast show Friday and today talking with Arab and Muslim Americans about what these investigative procedures and practices meant for their lives. You can find those stories on Friday's pod and on the Stateside show page at michiganradio.org. We hope you have some time to check them out. And that's the Stateside podcast for today. I'm April Baer. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Today's episode was produced by April Van Buren. Our theme music is by 14KT with additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. Thanks for listening. We're back with you tomorrow.